And now, with Sound Investing, here's Paul Merriman.
Well, this is one of those embarrassing moments. I was sorting through some old emails and then some old Excel pieces. Up pops a list of questions. And I don't know where this list of questions came from, but I know it was something I did online. And I may have said at the time, I promise I am going to answer these questions. So somebody or some of our listeners may recognize some of these questions, but here goes, because the questions I thought were really quite good. The first one has to do with the best investments to make and milestones. Now, that's all they've said, but I'm assuming they're wanting me to somehow respond maybe to different ages, different periods of their life, and what would be the best investments at those points in time. Well, of course, the best investment, appropriate balance of equity and fixed income asset classes, is going to be driven by your need for return and your willingness to take risk and all those things we teach. And if somebody really doesn't know, my best advice is to go to boot camp and work your way through those eight different major topics. And in each case, we give you an audio piece, we give you a video piece, we give you an article, and in almost every case, tons of tables to look at. Because there isn't one size fits all, with one exception. And that exception could be a target date fund, where everybody who's retiring in 2065 could theoretically, probably safely or appropriately, put their money into a Vanguard retirement target date fund that doesn't mature, but knows that you are maturing and theoretically retiring in 2065. So they'll be making adjustments in how much in equities and theoretically what equities and how much in bonds. But then what makes it kind of an interesting question to me is they have tagged on milestones. Now, there are so many milestones. A milestone that I'm sure is not shared with a lot of people, but I think is important, is that when you are getting started with whatever your asset allocation might be, when you're getting started and you think, where should I be in 10 or 20 years, given that I'm going to be investing a certain amount of money, what should I have? And what's interesting there is if you went out 10 years and you looked at the performance of the S&P 500 versus the different combinations of equity asset classes, each decade the returns, not only between the S&P 500 versus the others, but the returns from one decade to the next can be very, very different. And so it's difficult to talk about the milestones when you only talk about 20 years. In fact, I did a piece some weeks ago about the difference in returns over 20-year periods. Again, huge differences. Now, where it all tends to, at least in the way we look at numbers, where it kind of washes out is that the difference between the best and the worst 40-year period for the S&P 500 is 8.9%, the worst, and 12.5% the best. But then it even gets more complex, because by the time you adjust those two 40-year periods, there's only about 1% difference on an inflation-adjusted basis. Now, I'm going to assume that what this person had on their mind could be, and is often, how much should I have at a particular point in time, age-wise? And there is, and I'll have a link to this, but there is a Fidelity page that is devoted to this question, how much should you have by a particular age? For example, at 30 years of age, they want you to have one time your income saved by that point. And then by the time you get out to let's call it 65, they say they want you to have saved 10 times your annual salary. Well, that sounds good, but let's say that you started at the end of the first 10 years with an income of $60,000, and at the end of 40 years, let's say that you were making $140,000. And of course, with inflation, and if you're a professional, that would certainly not be an impossible task. But you know, 10 times 140,000 is 1.4 million. And I can tell you that since inflation is a whole bunch of the reason that your income will have gone up, it also suggests that 10 times that income that you have at the time you retire, that may not be enough. Now, I'm assuming they're including Social Security, but from my viewpoint, remembering that I want you to have more than enough, I would say at a minimum that you would want to not have 10, but even 15 or 20 times your last year's income in order to make sure you have enough to last for the rest of your life. But I want you to take a look at that that Fidelity piece. I think it's very interesting, and there's lots more good information in it for you. And question number two, do you recommend a solo 401k or SEP IRA for a single employee LLC that will never have employees? Now, I don't give tax advice. I'm not a financial planner. I really try to stay away from that arena. But here's the good news. We have the truth tellers, and the truth tellers dig deep into some of these topics. And just for fun, I picked one of them that I know does a lot of this kind of work, and that is Jim Dolly at White Coat Investor. And I simply did a search for White Coat Investor, solo 401k versus SEP IRA. And there it is, a wonderful article that I'm not even going to go into because I want you to read the whole thing, but there are seven reasons that Jim prefers the solo 401k versus the SEP IRA. So I hope you'll take a look at that. Again, we'll have a link there. Number three, how much alpha do you get with AVUV, which has higher fees, versus FISVX? That is the one of the Fidelity small cap value funds versus the Avantis. Now, it's a great question because the expense ratio of the Fidelity product is 0.05, 0.05%, as opposed to the AVUV, which has an expense ratio of 0.25, so five times the expense ratio. So how do we compare? Now, they want to know about the alpha, which really is a question about, do I expect to have enough additional return that you're going to end up with a better return with the Avantis fund. Now, I could go into a whole bunch of different ways that they run those funds differently that could lead to a higher return. I did look, since Avantis became available in September 2019, how have they done since then in terms of return? And the Avantis fund is up about 90%, and the Fidelity fund is up 39%. Now, is that because of the way that they manage the Avantis, or is there something else? Now, if we wanted to look at things like size and how deeply discounted and what difference, what big difference there might be, maybe in the quality of the companies. Well, it turns out that the companies are smaller on average with Fidelity, but they are also much more risky. If you look at the quality rating by Morningstar, you'll see that Fidelity has about the lowest rating you can get. In other words, they're small companies, but they're companies that aren't nearly as strong financially as the companies that Avantis owns. And so I'm going to guess that during this period of time that that the nod goes to Avantis because of this higher quality company. Now, what you'd like to know is, can we expect that much difference in the future? Because now that's almost twice as much return with the Avantis fund over a relatively short period of time. And I would have no idea how to measure how much difference there should be in the return of those two. But I've got lots of Avantis in my own portfolio, and I have DFA small cap value as well. In fact, just a sec here. Yeah, I just checked on the dimensional fund, the small cap value fund, and over that point, instead of a 90% return, it was about 77%, but both, and they have a lot of similarities because the people at Avantis, almost all of the leaders of the group have in fact come from dimensional funds, but both of them solidly outperformed the Fidelity. So, you know, my sense is that while Fidelity might do just fine, that you would get a higher than the difference between the 5/100s and the 25/100s in terms of that expense ratio. But we know what John Bogle said. John Bogle said that you should always go with the lower cost fund. But I think he probably also would have added this, of similar holding. So are those holdings similar? If one is small value in terms of the book value versus the market price and is a very low quality, and another is also low, the low market price versus the book value, but is of higher quality, you know, they're not exactly in the same asset class because of the way they're being managed. So that is a serious consideration. And I know that that is taken into consideration when Chris Pederson does his work in deciding, you know, which is the best in class, small cap value, large cap value, U.S. international, etc. Number four, I'm going to read this one and I'm going to respond to it. But not for the point of saving this person's problem, but to maybe kind of remember what kind of things I can legitimately respond to. This person says, I have $1.5 million sitting in cash, $1 million in an IRA, and $500,000 in a taxable account. Because interest rates are yielding 4% plus, it is sitting 43% equities, 57% bonds and cash. I have $5.8 million invested, no debt, have $90,000 in income annually. Should I adjust to a 60-40 equity fixed income split instead of, in essence, a 40-60 equities fixed income? Well, here's the challenge. I can't be this person's advisor, but if I were, I might want to know, well, if you're 43 equities now and 57% in bonds and cash, why are you there? Are you there because you're a market timer and you made a decision based on all of the variables that you take into consideration how much you wanted to have in equities? And now are you going through that same analysis and looking for somebody, if you are kind of wanting to move to a more aggressive equity position, you're looking for somebody to confirm what you already feel. And of course, I'm not the one to confirm that, because I still think that the amount of fixed income and equity that one needs requires a lot of conversation before we actually would make a recommendation. I will say this, that if somebody has, just for the sake of discussion, $6 million and a cost of living, of $120,000, and that means 2% a year, well, I mean, you can do well with a 2% distribution, whether you're 40, 60, 60, 40, 50, 50, 80, 20, 20, 80. I mean, you have the choice of all of those combinations depending upon how old you are, what your risk tolerance is. Is the money mostly really for your kids and not for you, in which case you might want to think more about investing like your kids are investing. So it's the kind of a question I really can't give the right answer to. Number five, and by the way, this may have come from the same person. If you only needed a 2% withdrawal rate, what asset allocation mix would you think would be appropriate for legacy investing, for what you leave to others? Now, I can tell you in our situation, my wife and I have commitments to nonprofits after we're gone. And so, and then of course, like most parents, going to leave some money to our kids. And so we are way beyond what would normally be advocated for a couple where one's 80 and the other one's 76, we're 50-50 stocks and bonds. And I want to be in the stock, more in stocks than maybe I should be. Now, when I say I should be, if you were in a target date fund at Vanguard, you would be 30% in equities, 70% in fixed income at my age. And so I think that's an important decision to make. You could even say that a lot, well, in fact, a lot of people do make the case for, if they have enough money to meet their cash flow needs from pensions and Social Security and real estate rentals or whatever it might be from, that they can have the rest of the money all in equities. They could also have it all in fixed income. It probably isn't going to change their lifestyle. But if what you're thinking about is leaving something to others, and you think you're going to be around for a while, then equities, and I should say more equities, I don't want to suggest all equities, but more equities than you would normally be comfortable with would, in fact, be a good answer. Number six, is there a time or wealth value that someone should get a trusted advisor? If so, how do you find them? Well, first of all, let's talk about the amount of money that one might have. It would be easy to say that if you don't have any money invested and you are establishing your plan for investing for the next, let's say, 20 years, and I pick on 20 years for, let's say, a first-time investor at age 21, because if they are going to build a foundation of wealth for the rest of their life, that first 20 years, they very likely want to be all in equities. And yet I just saw a study that showed that 57% of the people that are that age have their money in savings accounts as opposed to equities, and see savings accounts as being a better investment. So I'll tell you, if you didn't have any money and you were just getting started and you came to somebody like me that is involved in the process, I don't give advice anymore, but involved enough to be able to tell you what we know from the past is the right thing to do, it may be hiring somebody like me at 1% would be a bargain because you don't have any money. So if you had $1,000 to begin with, that means you're going to pay me basically $10 to give you your advice that you need to get started. By the way, that would be so cheap. But if you paid me for the rest of your life and you did a good job in terms of saving, and my advice did a good job in terms of making you money, and you lived, well, in fact, you lived way beyond me more than likely, but that you stayed with either myself or my partner or whoever survived me in my business, and you did that your whole life, that early cost of $10 will be small compared to what that cost will be when you have $1 million or $5 million or $10 million. So a 1% fee on a $1,000 account is a bargain. You're not going to find somebody to do that. But what you might find is somebody by the hour. And it can't be very complex because you don't have anything. They're going to look at what you consider your future to be in terms of income, and you have figured out what saving you're likely, and then let them give you the advice. If they charged you a $200 for that, that would be a bargain. So I think people need advice from day one. But typically people think of taking advice only when they have enough money that they're nervous managing it themselves, or they think if they're making a mistake, it can be really costly. Well, if you make a mistake as a 20-year-old, I will tell you some of the biggest money you'll ever make will be on the first 5 years what you do with your money that you invest. The first 5 years could theoretically end up, depending on how you handle that, being 25 to 50% of what you have when you retire. So how much you have, as far as I'm concerned, is not the problem. The problem is finding an advisor. Everybody needs advice. Some people come to our website for advice. They don't want to pay anybody anything, and maybe they'll be able to get enough information. One of the reasons we've got the truth tellers on our website is so that when you're done reading my stuff, you can go learn from Rob Berger or Larry Swedbro or Jim Dolly or Jonathan Clements or George Sisti. I mean, these people are smarter than I am. And so there are good people for you to learn from so that you don't ever have to pay anybody. But if you are going to get advice and you want to get it on an hourly basis, then I will give you in the notes, I will have two links. One to an organization that the folks will do either hourly or a percentage of money under management, and a second will be to an organization where the people only work by the hour. Now, let me tell you the problem. I think in this week's newsletter, I'm going to have a link to another podcast that I was on at the end of last year. I did it with a Dr. Robert Pass. And Rob does a weekly podcast that is really popular. I mean, I can't believe how many cardiac surgeons, pediatrics, by the way, cardiac surgeries, surgeons go to his website. And it's always about medical stuff, except once a year, he does a piece on finance. And he's been kind enough to invite me over the last 4 years to be the guest. And so I'll have a link to that interview. But on that interview, we talk about this topic of hourly, finding hourly people. And I, as an example, I gave a person that I know that I think is good. I like his business model. And I called and I talked to him a couple days ago, and I said, I'm just curious whether you had any response to me mentioning your name. And he said, well, I'm not sure, but I'm not able to talk to any more clients now through about October of next year. I'm sorry, of this year. So that's the downside of a good hourly person or people who work by the project. Some people may not charge you exactly an hour rate, but they may work for you for a day for a certain amount of money, basically. But it's not an arrangement where you keep paying for the rest of your life. So I'll have those two links to where I know you can find these hourly people, but I just want to warn you, it may take a while for you to be able to work with them. Then there's the people who work as a percentage of money under management. They are much easier to find because those organizations, and that's what my old firm, they're doing the same thing. And when an advisor has a full book of business, they have to have another advisor to come in and start taking the newer clients because you can only handle 150 to 200 clients on a full-time management basis, and then you got to let somebody else do it, because if you're going to do the job that you should for somebody you're charging 1% a year or 0.9%, very different kind of business than going to Vanguard for 30 basis points or about a third of 1%. So you're going to have an easier time finding qualified people who are working for a percentage of money under management. Also, those people make a lot more than people who work hourly. A lot of the people who work hourly are not excited about finding a lifetime relationship with a client. What they are excited to do, and it is fun, is being the person who's responsible for that original plan and the lifetime strategy that's built around it. So I would, as far as finding a good investment advisor, what's important to me is that you deal with people who the underlying portfolios are index funds. And you don't want to be paying over 1%. Some people do charge as much as 2% and tell people they're getting a higher quality service for that extra, you get what you pay for. And this is the case where I don't agree. And you want people who are going to be able to commit to the time that you want. For example, if you went to my free book, it's called Get Smart or Get Screwed, How to Select the Best and Get the Most Out of Your Advisor. For example, a lot of people don't know that a good advisor will typically, at no cost at all, give guidance to other members in the family. Or maybe they will charge something, but they'll charge based on the whole family instead of trying to have you stand alone as the client or the children to be a standalone client because they would likely charge them a lot more, particularly if you've got lots of money under that management's responsibility. If you like numbers and you like people who know numbers, and if you like to have tax advice and you want people who will do that, I do think that if you can find a CPA who has a PFS designation, personal finance specialist, they are basically the equivalent of a certified financial planner, but they also really know taxes. Most investment advisors are not allowed legally to give tax advice because they're not licensed to do it. They may do it, but if you have a complex tax situation, you want to go to somebody who's actually qualified to give that advice. So that the CPAs, certainly if you talk to your CPA and tell them you're looking for either an hourly advisor or somebody who they trust will do a good job and make sure whoever they recommend is using index or passively managed portfolios and absolutely no commissions. And the next question is, how should a 50-something make changes in their 401k to boost the returns? Well, first of all, this would be true of anybody in theory. It does seem to get more important that you do all this right when you're 50 because you don't have that many years, working years and saving years ahead of you to be making the mistakes you might have made earlier in your life. But I would be focusing on the things that, if you ever read the book, We're Talking Millions, 12 Simple Ways to Supercharge Your Retirement, well, a lot of the answers to this question are in that book, even though that book was theoretically written for more of a first-time investor. But how much you're paying in expenses, it's a big deal. I run into a lot of people, or when I was an advisor, especially a lot of people, and they had a portfolio filled with a bunch of tax-exempt bond funds that have very high expense ratios. And so I wouldn't want that. In virtually every case like that, I was recommending that there were no tax implications of any significance, that they look at moving those tax-exempt bond funds over to Vanguard instead of using Franklin or something similar to that. Big difference. Could be a quarter to 0.5% a year. And that's money that falls to the bottom line, by the way. Certainly, if you have actively managed funds inside of your 401k, oh, I would rather see you not only because of lower expenses, but also because of higher expected returns with less risk because you're going to have more diversification in an index fund than an actively managed fund. That could, by the way, underperform over the next 10 years by as much as 2% a year, what the benchmark index would have made. I say could have because I never know. But actively managed funds long-term way underperformed, except for a few. About one out of every 10 or 20 advisors or managers are able to beat the index itself. I also think you should look at your combination of money in equities and fixed income. Now, you will see that some glide paths will have quite a bit in fixed income when they're in their 50s. But that might not be appropriate for you. You may be planning to work till you're 70. So maybe you could, whatever, let's say you've got 60% in equities, you might be able to pick up some extra return, and if you've got that kind of time ahead of you. Even if you got 10 years ahead of you, another 10% in equities is likely to add about a half of 1%. Let's say, for the sake of discussion, because it depends how much fixed income you've got, but let's say 0.3 half of 1% additional return. Be meaningful. Certainly be meaningful in retirement. I also think you need to be testing your risk tolerance, because you may, this is not unusual, have almost 100% of your money in equities at age 50, and do you want to actually cut that back? Do you need to take that much risk? You could maybe go all the way down to 70 or 60%. Well, not at age 50, but you may want to be taking, if you're 50, 55, taking 20% off the table and putting that into fixed income at that point. It should be, all of it should be part of a plan. What are your thoughts on robo-advisors and investing? I think they're amazing. I love target date funds for young people and even middle-aged people. Target date funds are basically just robo-advised funds, and they're all over the industry. Of course, I want you to be in a no-load one, and of course, I want you to be in one that uses index funds as the underlying investments. Now, what I don't like about that kind of robo-advised fund is they tend not to have much money in small cap or in value. And some of the robo-advisors do have some. Now, as you probably understand that our portfolios, the 8 portfolios that we show you under sound investing portfolios, those are meant to be, in essence, the basis of robo-advised portfolios, except you are the robot, not somebody else. You don't pay anybody else to do it. You simply adopt one of those strategies. And we actually, I think, show you more about those strategies on the 2 or 3 pages of returns and risk, and both in good times and bad, and short-term and long-term. And I really encourage you, if you haven't looked at those pages, and I'll have a link to those pages, to consider that as your robo-advisor. Now, what is your advice for a parent to persuade their adult children to educate themselves about investments? Oh, that is a huge topic. I can't tell you how many couples I've spoken to that have 2 or more children who will then tell me the story about how different all of their children are. Some have absolutely no interest in money and saving it. Others have a lot of interest in money and spending it. Others, the kids are not high spenders, but money and those investment decisions make them nervous. And so they'd rather just put their money in some sort of a riskless investment. I think you need to figure out a way to have a relationship with the child where you're not trying to shove something down their throats. And the reason I mention this is because so often when I talk to parents who are trying to help their children in this regard, they know exactly what they want their kids to do. But I think to be more gentle about it and figure out some way to reward them. Now, and this may sound strange, but I think probably the greatest reward you could give them, and actually mean it when you give it to them, is you could say, you know, your mother and I, or your father and I, I've been talking about the fact that we don't get a sense that you have made investing and understanding how to invest a priority at all in your life. And we understand, because we also understand you don't have much money to do that with right now. And you can theoretically put that off. But we do feel differently about that. And I want you to know that this is really important to us. Here's the situation. We have accumulated quite a bit. And eventually, some portion of that is going to go to you and your family, and to your siblings and their families. But there's something that we feel strongly about. We will have worked a lifetime, saved aggressively. We put off and delayed gratification on things we could have spent money on that would have been fun. But instead, we thought about the longer term with part of it. And if we die, and of course, we're not going to be around to see any of this going on, it will really be heartbreaking to us if after we did all that sacrificing, that you basically blew the money. Because we see that money as being something that could, for you as it has for us, helped us keep and establish a really nice lifestyle and give us the ability to give more gifts than we might otherwise have, or travel more than we might otherwise have traveled. And so here, and I'm sorry to do so much talking about this, but it's kind of a difficult thing to say. But what we have to watch is, what do we think your ability is to legitimately handle this money? So here's our thought. We watch. We see how you're handling your own money. By the way, we're not going to be judgmental about how much you're spending. But I can tell you, we're going to be really interested in how you're saving. And not even so much how much you're saving, although that'll be interesting, but how you save, what kinds of decisions you make. And you may say, well, how do I know what to do? Well, you know what you could do? You could start here. There are lots of books on investing. But there's one, it's called We're Talking Millions, 12 Simple Ways to Supercharge Your Retirement. And I know you're not focused on your retirement right now, but I promise you will be. But let me tell you, in that book, the first half of the book is written for people who are going to take some responsibility, kind of want to do it all themselves. But the last half of that book talks about a way to invest that you will get really good professional management for the rest of your life and not have to do a doggone thing. I mean that, not a thing, because it will be done by professionals, and some of the smartest professionals in the industry, and they're called a target date fund. And about half of this book is about target date funds. And then you'll see in that book, they show you, tell you how to use target date funds, and then they'll suggest maybe you take 10% of the money and put it in a type of fund that is different than a target date fund. And when you get there, if it gets a little confusing, come see me. We'll talk about it, or we'll find another article to read about it. But I really want you to know that your mother and I, or your father and I, are taking this seriously, because we want what we have saved for you to be meaningful for you for the rest of your life. And when you're 70 years old and you are sitting on the beach in Hawaii and having a Coke or a Mai Tai, or whatever, And you're sitting there feeling good, and you might even think, boy, am I glad that Mom and Dad took me aside and got me going. Now, what you could also do is add some sort of a reward for having finished reading that book, or if it isn't that book, which is free as a PDF on our website. It could be a free book called If You Can by Bill Bernstein. Or it could be a free book called Financial Physics by Don McDonald. There are lots of people trying to help that are not looking to take a dime from your kids. So there's one idea. I don't want to bore you with a whole bunch of, I'll come up with more in the future, but I think some sort of a heart-to-heart talk about how meaningful, how important this is. And oh, by the way, I forgot to mention, if we do come to the conclusion that you're not qualified to take care of that money, that's okay. But what we're thinking about doing is leaving it to you in a way, it's a fantastic way, that would virtually create the equivalent of a pension, so that every month you'd get a check and it would help support you in your life. But you know what that means to us? We wouldn't have to worry about you blowing it, or somebody conning you out of it, or somebody taking it from you in a divorce. So just know what we have is you on our heart, nobody else. Anyway, there you go. There's my idea for the week. Let's see, what's the next one here? Somebody says, will this program be recorded? If anybody recognizes one of these questions and they have any idea what recording this came from, would you email me, paul@paulmerriman.com, and I'll be able to put that in the note field. Last question. What do you do with penny stocks that are down 80, 90% what you paid for? That's a tough one because, you know, you got this feeling, the minute I sell this, it's going to turn around and it's going to go up and I will have missed that opportunity. And let me tell you why it will go up. And this is really cynical, but here's what I believe. These penny stocks are used to scam people over and over again and to create a story. And so what often they'll do, they'll create that story around a penny stock that already exists but is worth next to nothing. Then they figure out a way to do a merger with that penny stock company and to pump and dump again. But there's got to be a story, some exciting product. Maybe it has something to do with AI. Ooh, that'd be good. There was a time. In fact, Jason Zweig talks about it in one of my favorite books, Your Money and Your Brain, about just how they named companies back in the period of 1988, 89, 2000. Just the name of a company would cause it to double or triple or quadruple because people thought it had something to do with the future of technology. So if you don't know when they're going to run it again, then what you do is you sell it. Theoretically, you'll have a stock tax write-off, and you take the write-off and the refund you get and the money that you get, and you reinvest it again for the long term, if that's what it was meant to be. But you want to take higher risk, small cap value would be higher risk than the S&P 500. But it's never the right time to do the wrong thing. And that is important. But I can tell you that the self-talk that we have around taking that loss is really bad, because we can say every time you see that, oh, God, how could I have been so stupid? And every time you look at it, how could I have been so stupid? I mean, and over again. And then you maybe have a spouse who reminds you of it. So I would try to encourage people to move on, but not to move on to invest in another small penny stock, okay? All right, well, that's it for today. I love you. These were great questions. And I'm embarrassed because what I very often say is, if I can't get to these questions, I'll do a podcast and then we'll get the answers out to you. Well, at age 80, I forget things sometimes. And this is one of those things I forgot. So I hope somebody can tell me. And thanks for listening. It is an honor to work for you and with you. And I mean that. Those emails that you send that tell me the impact of what we do, yes, sometimes we use them as we don't mention your name. We'll put initials in there, in which case, if you don't like your initials, change them. And but we think that those people who have benefited from our work, what they have to say means a lot to others. So thank you for all of that. And of course, the contributions. We've had a lot of $10 and $25 contributions since the first of the year. We appreciate them all, even the ones that are smaller than $5. They all count. Thank you.
That was Paul Merriman with Sound Investing. Sound Investing, soundinvesting.com, and paulmerriman.com are produced and exclusively owned by Paul Merriman, who is solely responsible for their content. For more information, free articles, mutual fund recommendations, and more, visit paulmerriman.com.